It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, four candidates are running for an open seat on the state Supreme Court. We'll start a series of interviews this week by meeting two of those candidates and talking about the biggest issues facing the justices. First, a federal appeals court overturned a federal law last week that prevents people from owning firearms while they are under a restraining order for domestic violence. The court cited a U.S. Supreme Court ruling from last summer that said gun laws should be evaluated based on historical tradition. It's one of the most prominent examples of that landmark Supreme Court ruling changing gun law in the United States. It has legal scholars wondering what could be next. You can join in at 800-642-1234 on this specific case. Do you think the federal government or state or local government should have the ability to say a person can't have a firearm in their possession while they're under a domestic violence restraining order? Do you like that idea? Not like it? Why? Why not? Do you have wider concerns about the way guns are regulated? Recent changes in court rulings on firearms. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Eric Rubin is an assistant professor of law at the Dedman School of Law at Southern Methodist University in Texas and a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University's School of Law. His work focuses on guns, the Second Amendment, and criminal law. Eric, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be here, Rob.
Can you tell us a little more about this this court ruling on the domestic violence restraining orders and guns?
Sure. So the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which covers Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi, struck down a decades-old U.S. law that barred domestic abusers from possessing firearms. And in particular, the way the law operated was that it barred gun possession by people who are subject to civil domestic violence restraining orders. And in this case, the defendant, whose name was Zaki Rahimi, assaulted his girlfriend, had agreed to a restraining order that prohibited from possessing firearms, and then was caught with firearms. And when he was prosecuted, he challenged the restriction as unconstitutional, as a violation of the Second Amendment.
Before we get to the grounds for that, this was a federal law. I understand some states have comparable laws, and those are, at least for now, still in effect. Do I have that right?
Yeah, so a lot of states have similar restrictions on firearm possession following domestic violence restraining orders. And those were not immediately affected by this ruling. And in fact, this ruling only is going to govern Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi, where the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals has jurisdiction. So the rest of the country thus far is not going to be bound or controlled by this decision.
Presumably that may change. It will go to the Supreme Court, and I can imagine challenges to state laws eventually making their way through the federal court system. Is that something you expect to see happen?
Right now, after the Bruin decision from this past June, which really upheaved the way that courts are applying the Second Amendment, we're seeing all gun restrictions, in fact, all weapons restrictions, being challenged as a violation of the Second Amendment. The field of weapons regulation is immense, and we're seeing challenges not only to domestic violence restraining orders, but to restrictions on bringing guns to certain places, the types of weapons that you are allowed to possess, for instance, automatic weapons versus semi-automatic weapons. So we're certainly going to see a lot more litigation around domestic violence restraining orders, and even disqualifying people who are subject to who have been convicted of domestic violence offenses from possessing a firearm. There's going to be a lot of litigation in the coming months and years.
Talking to law professor Eric Rubin from Southern Methodist University about a new court ruling on domestic violence restraining orders and guns and wider issues after a big Supreme Court ruling last summer. And Eric, let's get into that ruling now, the Bruin ruling. The majority in the court gave, in effect, a new standard for how to evaluate firearm regulations under the Second Amendment. What changed?
Sure. So, the specific issue in that case was a century-old regulation in New York City, or New York State, rather, that said that before you can carry a gun, handgun in public, you need to get a permit. In order to get that permit, you needed to show that you were at a heightened risk of being attacked. It was not a domestic violence restriction, and the court ultimately struck down that restriction. But the reason why that opinion even affected other issues like domestic violence restrictions on firearm possession is that, as you mentioned, the Supreme Court said that going forward, courts are going to have to apply a novel test for deciding on the constitutionality of gun laws. In particular, courts have to assess, after Bruin, whether a given restriction is consistent with historical tradition. And to do that, the Supreme Court said that the government has to point to analogous regulations from back in the late 1700s when the Second Amendment was adopted, or maybe into the 1800s. And of course, when it comes to something like domestic violence restraining orders, the government is having a hard time doing that because back in the late 1700s, our moral compass when it comes to gendered violence was totally different. In fact, it was gendered violence, domestic violence was viewed as a private matter. There was even something called a right of chastisement where husbands had the right to discipline their wives and children. So of course there were no restrictions on gun possession for domestic abusers back then. And that makes it hard for the government to try to analogize to other sorts of things that did exist.
And that late 1700s standard, I mean, most practical firearms at that point had exactly one round at a time, as I understand it. So a law that restricted magazine capacity, would that face the same kind of challenge while there were no such laws in the late 1700s?
Absolutely. There's a big problem of what historians call anachronism. Reading history through a modern day lens. The firearms back in the late 1700s were very different. They were muzzle loaders that were unsafe to keep loaded. So a lot of the historical research on the sorts of crimes and weapons use that happened back then did not involve guns at all. In fact, a lot of crime just happened with whatever was close at hand, not firearms, but knives and blunt force objects and the like. So it was a very different time with respect to technology. Technology's advanced a great deal, but there's also been an incredible amount of social change since then. And when it comes to domestic violence, it's very readily apparent.
Let's bring on a caller. Nancy is with us in Rib Mountain. Nancy, hi.
Hi. I would just like to add to that. Women are not property anymore, even though our legislature is beginning to think we are. And I think if you are arrested for domestic or you are under a restraining order, you have no business holding a firearm. And overall, I'd like to see the 3-day waiting period reinstated just for safety reasons.
Nancy, thanks for the call. Eric, what do you think?
Yes, no, I think that there's no doubt that removing firearms from domestic abusers can prevent homicides. In fact, women are 5 times more likely to die in a domestic violence situation if a gun is present. Every single month, an average of 70 women are shot and killed by an intimate partner. This is one of those areas of gun policy where the empirics all point in one direction. But one of the things that the court said here is that the question, I'm quoting from the opinion. This is the very first sentence. The question presented in this case is not whether prohibiting the possession of firearms by someone subject to a domestic violence restraining order is a laudable policy goal. And then it goes on to say the question is whether or not this is consistent with history or tradition. So the court, in essence, and a lot of courts after Bruin, are basically saying that modern day realities, modern day empirics are not relevant.
Thanks for the call, Nancy. We're talking to Southern Methodist University law professor Eric Rubin about gun laws and a recent court ruling that struck down, at least in one part of the country, a federal firearm ban for people under restraining orders for domestic violence. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of that decision and the Bruin decision we're talking about that says, hey, you want a gun law, you have to find an analogy with something from the late 1700s when the Second Amendment came into effect? Call in with your thoughts, your questions on how this all works at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up the conversation with Eric Rubin, law professor at Southern Methodist University, expert on the Second Amendment. He's with us today to look at the legal implications of a federal appeals court ruling that struck down the law banning gun ownership for people under restraining orders for domestic violence. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on that particular ruling. Also on big changes from the U.S. Supreme Court on the standards that have to be met when it comes to gun laws around the country, saying there has to be an analogy to the late 1700s. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We lost our guest there for a moment, but Eric, we have you back. Are there other cases now you see in the courts right now under Bruin that you're keeping a particularly close eye on that we could see, as you said, a big upheaval?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, there's a lot of litigation going on right now, a lot of litigation. One of the areas of litigation that we're seeing is further refinement of where it's permissible to bar people from carrying guns in public. So after the Bruin decision, which struck down a century-old law in New York as not old enough, the state legislatures in places like New York and New Jersey and California are passing new laws that are saying, okay, well, it's easier to get a permit, but we're going to restrict you from carrying that gun in certain places, like zoos and casinos and beaches and libraries. And a lot of those place-based restrictions are getting struck down. In fact, just last week, a court in New Jersey struck down a restriction on bringing guns into zoos and libraries and casinos and I believe even airports. So there's just a lot of litigation right now. I think people are surprised by the sorts of restrictions that are getting struck down. Another court said that it's unconstitutional and a violation of the Second Amendment to require or to bar the possession of firearms without serial numbers, so-called ghost guns. And the court said, look, there were no serial numbers back in the late 1700s, and there's no requirement for serial numbers, so we can't require them now. So there's differing opinions amongst the courts. There are splits looking at the same historical record and coming out to different conclusions. There's just a lot of litigation, and all around, it's a bit of a mess right now.
Yeah, I've seen people say the Bruin ruling, in effect, makes judges turn into historians in their spare time.
It definitely places a huge emphasis on a different sort of litigation argument than lawyers are used to making and judges are used to seeing. One judge in California asked the parties to submit not briefs, but a spreadsheet with a list of all of the historical laws that might be relevant to the dispute. And that's just not an ordinary form of argumentation that you see in the courts.
Let's bring on another caller now. Margarita is with us in Wisconsin Rapids. Margarita, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question. For people who have a record of domestic violence that was, among quotations, clear, how is that new law addressing them, you know, as people who have a record of domestic violence and they have a gun or they have guns in their homes?
Margarita, thanks for the call. Yeah, how is that enforced, Eric, or how is that enforced?
Yeah, sure. So, well, one thing with respect to these domestic violence restraining orders, they're temporary restrictions on the possession of firearm. They're not they tend not to just go on to infinity. They're temporary. They're usually for a year or maybe 2 years. And then there are a series of court hearings when the court decides whether or not they should stay in place. Enforcement of these laws is a big problem. And one of the things that happened in this case was that Rahimi, the defendant here, had agreed to a domestic violence restraining order, agreed to give up his gun, and then didn't give up his gun. In fact, he assaulted his girlfriend, which led to the restraining order. But even though he wasn't allowed to have a gun, he later shot several times into the home of a person who he sold drugs. He got in a car accident and then it shot at the other driver. He shot into a law enforcement vehicle. And there were other incidents as well. And so all of this, he should not have had a gun during these incidents because of the domestic violence restraining order. But I think that goes to the point that a lot of the enforcement of this is just that you hope that the threat of a criminal sanction will deter people from possessing firearms.
Thanks for the call, Margarita. Eric, you'd mentioned splits in the courts. I've seen some speculation that there might be some buyer's remorse from some of the members of the U.S. Supreme Court who voted, who concurred with this Bruin opinion. Justice Thomas, I think, wrote the majority opinion. There's talk that a couple of the other conservative, quote-unquote, justices might want to dial it back. Do you think there's anything to that?
There might be. It's really difficult to know. The Bruin opinion itself, the majority opinion, all six justices signed onto it. But then there are two concurrences. One of the concurrences was by Justice Brett Kavanaugh. It was joined by Chief Justice John Roberts. And in that concurrence, Kavanaugh made very clear that the ruling does not affect the ability to require permits for the public carrying of firearms, even though, and this went unsaid or unanalyzed, even though permits weren't required for public carry of firearms back in the late 1700s. And also said that the opinion in Bruin didn't call into question some of the sorts of restrictions that the Supreme Court blessed over a decade earlier in a case called Heller. And those restrictions included bars on gun possession by felons and the mentally ill, and bringing firearms into certain sensitive places, even though those restrictions don't have clear historical analogs. So it's possible that even though even while the Supreme Court imposed this novel test that doesn't apply in other areas of constitutional law, some of the justices are less wedded to it than others. And ultimately, because of these splits, because important laws are getting struck down, the Supreme Court's going to have to get back involved sooner rather than later to provide a bit of clarity.
We'll leave it there. Eric, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Eric Rubin is an assistant professor of law at Southern Methodist University in Texas and a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University. He's with us today for a look at the impact of a ruling by a federal appeals court that overturned in that district a law, a federal law, that prohibited people from owning guns while under a restraining order for domestic violence. A new survey of students in the University of Wisconsin system has added fuel to the debate over free speech on college campuses, but that debate has been going on for years. Students, professors, and college administrators all face decisions about what speech should be protested and how. Rich Kramer reports.
Days after former Republican President Donald Trump's 2016 victory, conservative commentator Ben Shapiro stepped to the podium in a crowded UW-Madison lecture hall.
Please join me in welcoming Mr. Ben Shapiro.
Shapiro mocked around 20 protesters in the room he deemed social justice warriors. The group responded by periodically interrupting his presentation. The protesters' disruption of the event would become a flashpoint in a national battle over free speech on campus. In 2017, Wisconsin Republicans introduced a bill mandating punishments up to expulsion for UW students who repeatedly disrupt free speech on campus. That legislation never made it to the desk of then-Governor Scott Walker, but the UW System Board of Regents was then made up almost entirely of Republican appointees. They passed a resolution that mirrored some of the bill's language. Former UW System President Ray Cross headed the state's universities at the time.
What I think the Shapiro incident may have triggered is an exposure of one of the flaws that I felt we had in our policy.
Cross says the university does want to protect speakers against what's known as the heckler's veto. That's when the loudest voices are allowed to shut down views they reject. The debate over what free speech on campus should look like is messy. A survey of more than 10,000 UW System students released this month found around half of respondents believed speakers should be disinvited from campus if some find their message offensive. It also found conservative students were more likely to feel pressure to self-censor in class.
I thought that it's at least a good first step.
That's UW-Madison student Jake Rivard. He took the survey. He calls himself a free speech absolutist and chairs the campus chapter of conservative group Young America's Foundation, which invited Shapiro in 2016. Last fall, YAF invited nationally known conservative author Matt Walsh to campus to screen his documentary titled What is a Woman?, which is critical of transgender identity and medical care. Rivard says the event sold out with hundreds more trying to get in.
What it tells me on the surface is that people are interested, at least to hear what he has to say, even if they don't, you know, agree with everything. I don't agree with everything that Matt says, but there's a part of what he says that, you know, I can get behind and I can support.
Ahead of Walsh's event, the student union was vandalized with spray-painted messages calling him a pedophile and Nazi. About 100 protesters rallied outside the event, including PhD candidate Caitlin Benedetto, who argues Walsh's rhetoric ignores growing hostility toward transgender people.
He's signaling and perhaps fomenting even more suspicion and even violence towards trans people.
The protests did not disrupt the event itself. Everyone supports the broad concept of free speech, but sometimes the blinders go on, says Joe Cohn with the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, or FIRE. The national group has represented students, professors, and campus newspapers in lawsuits against university speech policies.
And if we lose the ability to kind of grapple with the uncomfortable conversations, even the ugliness of some views that might be out there in the world, we're going to have a much harder time as a society grappling with those issues when those students become the people in power.
The debate over free speech on campus is far from settled in Wisconsin, and the recent student survey results mark a new chapter as Republican legislators craft the state's next budget. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, we'll start a series of interviews with candidates in the race for Wisconsin's open state Supreme Court seat this year for primary candidates running for two places in the general election. And by the way, join Wisconsin Public Radio tonight at 8 for live coverage of the 2023 State of the Union Address from President Biden and the Republican response, live hosted coverage from the folks over at NPR. Listen here on Wisconsin Public Radio or online at WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a dream about hibernation.
Some animals hibernate to survive the winter. Humans aren't included in that group, but that hasn't stopped writer Krista Eastman from imagining her perfect winter abode.
Before natural historians understood that some birds fly thousands of miles south each winter, they looked for other ways to explain their disappearance. Birds were like snakes, they suggested, burrowing for themselves a hibernaculum, an earthy pocket in which to pass the winter. Under the ground, the robin slumbered, her heart beating once in a while, her open throat not tweeting at all, her feathers caked in grit. This was another way to survive the winter, digging in, admitting no one, waiting for this too to pass. Deep into the winter blues, I awake to early morning darkness and wonder, is there really no other place for people and animals to live? Is there no other way? Some people are practical in coping with the season. Swift in booking cheap flights to Florida, they do not hesitate, they do not dally, they just depart. I am a member of that other tribe, those who dig in, those who let their thoughts grow warped on the grayest light of winter. At some point, usually around January 14th, I surrender to the season. My most insignificant problems begin to appear to me as uncontainable irritations, crosswords I'm much too grumpy to solve. It's hard, then, not to fantasize about my own hibernaculum, how I'd stock mine with a 5-month supply of coffee, chocolate, cheese, and wine to be consumed in that order every day, all winter long. Add to that a pile of books and a landline that only dials out for delivery. This would be the season of slow and silent contemplation, moderate melancholy, little to no exercise. A wise friend of mine claims this is what winter is for, a natural slowing down, a time to reflect, a not so unhealthy space for feeling a little bit sad. If it were possible, I think I'd also loft my hibernaculum in a tree and make of it a warm and protected nest. And then I'd also probably appoint someone responsible for yanking open the nest trap door once spring had truly come. I'd fall to the ground in an unwashed heap, stand up, blink my eyes. I imagined then that my pitying neighbors would gather round to watch as I stood for the first time in months, stretching muscles, cracking joints. "She smells even worse than last year," one of them might mutter, as I crab walk off to the lake for a bracing spring rinse. But I won't do any of that, of course, not really. I will climb out of bed when my son wakes each morning. I will be on time for work. I will remember to bring home that carton of eggs. But someday I will also emerge vainglorious from winter's pocket. It will be suddenly warm, and I will be suddenly awake, and soon, my naked ankles frisky from sun, I'll wonder, what could be better than here? What way is there but this?
Krista Eastman's essays have appeared in the Georgia Review, the Kenyon Review, and other journals. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit our website at wisconsinlife.org and find us on Facebook and on Twitter. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Central Time. Now, four candidates are running for an open seat on the state Supreme Court. The outcome of the April general election could shift the ideological balance of the court, which is widely seen as having a 4-3 conservative majority in the current lineup. Before the primary election on February 21st, we invited all the candidates to join us to talk about the race. We're going to talk with two of them today. Danielle Kelly served as a state Supreme Court justice from 2016 until 2020 and is now running for a new term. Justice Kelly, thanks for being with us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Can you give us your brief elevator pitch about your case for being back on the court?
Sure. I think it starts where it has to start, with my service on the Supreme Court. It was the greatest professional honor of a lifetime to serve the people of Wisconsin as one of their Supreme Court justices. I loved every moment of it, and I especially loved the relationship between the people of Wisconsin and me. That's servant and boss. So I understood that all the authority that I exercised belonged to them, so I was serving them as my bosses during that entire time. Now, the work that I've done on the Supreme Court, I've written several landmark opinions on constitutional matters, and the body of my work has been quoted, cited, or relied upon hundreds of times by courts here in Wisconsin and across the country. And so as I've traveled the state of Wisconsin, I've listened to what folks have told me, and they tell me they want to make sure that the next Supreme Court justice has a long public record of fidelity to the original public meaning of the Constitution. And they say they see that in me, and so they asked me to run, and I've accepted their kind offer to run.
Now, a lot of times voters might look at a court race and treat it like a political race. We want candidates who go with the policies we like, the outcomes we like. You are making the case that voters shouldn't do that. What do you hope they look at instead?
Yeah, so we have the court is a non-political branch. All the political questions are to be decided in the legislature, not in the courts. So the way that we do the job to ensure that we are faithful to the Constitution of the people of Wisconsin is a methodology that I followed my entire time on the court. And that is you start with the law, and whether it's a constitutional provision, statute, regulation, or common law, and then you use rigorous logic to move from that all the way down to the conclusion. And when you're done, you should be able to look back and see an unbroken chain of logic between the conclusion and the premises, the law. And if you do, that's your guarantee that the conclusion is commanded by law and has not been affected by any personal values or politics.
So when people ask you about particular issues, redistricting or abortion, what do you say to them?
I say the same boring thing that I do every single time. I will decide those cases the same way I've decided all cases on the Supreme Court, according to what the law commands. In fact, the other day I was promising people that one of my superpowers is to be boring, and that I am running to be the most boring member of the Supreme Court and in the state's entire history, because the role of the court does not change depending on what type of issue or which particular issue it's addressing. It's always the same. Take the law that already exists and apply that to resolve the case without respect to your personal values or politics, and you do that today, and then you do the same thing tomorrow, and the day after that, ad infinitum. Every single day, the job is exactly the same without regard to the issue before you.
Your campaign put out a press release with the title, Justice Kelly is the only candidate endorsed by all three Wisconsin pro-life groups. Now, you can't control who endorses you, of course, but does it make a statement to voters, sharing that with the public, that they might expect you to vote a particular way on pro-life and or abortion issues?
Well, I don't think so. If they look carefully at the endorsements, so those organizations, the conversation I had with them was that they want a justice who follows the law, who is faithful to the original public meaning of the Constitution, faithful to the terms of the statute that people have adopted, and that's what they're looking for. They haven't asked me to rule in any particular way on any particular issue. All they want is to be able to address issues in the constitutional manner, to resolve political questions in the legislature and resolve legal questions in the court.
The perception, though, is, you know, people refer to the conservative justices, the liberal justices, voting on high profile issues often, not always, but often plays out that way. They're not politicians in robes once they hit the Supreme Court?
Well, I'm not. And I think each individual justice is responsible for answering to the Constitution's call to be impartial, to set aside your personal politics and just do the work of the court. And that's what I've done. And I invite all jurists, whether on the Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals or the Circuit Court, to do the exact same thing. Don't allow your personal values or politics influence the work of the court. If we allow that, that's where people's confidence and trust in the judiciary starts to fail. And if we allow that to start to fail, people will question whether justice is available in our courts. And so this methodology that I have of careful and precise logic in applying the law to resolve cases is meant to not only be faithful to the Constitution and the people of Wisconsin, but to engender in them confidence that justice can be found, and it can be found in Wisconsin courts.
Once in a great while, an issue comes up where at least some members of the public or one party or another say this particular justice should recuse him or herself from this case. What do you think are the right standards for recusal of state Supreme Court justices?
Well, I think any time that there is a circumstance in which a jurist is not completely confident that he can decide the case in front of him without being unduly influenced by a contribution, by a relationship, by any other factor, that person should recuse him or herself. One of the responsibilities of a jurist is not only to be impartial in fact, but also to project that impartiality in appearance. And so when there are circumstances where a reasonable person just would not be confident that the jurist is going to decide the case according to the law, that's something that the jurist should seriously take into account in making a recusal decision.
We hope for civility on the court amongst the justices. There have been moments on Wisconsin's state Supreme Court where it didn't always work out so well. What would your approach be to a collegial relationship?
Yeah, that's a great question. It was one that I was asked when I first joined the court. And my answer today is the same as it was then. And it's the way I've tried to conduct myself in all collegial atmospheres. And that involves you walk humbly, you love unconditionally, and you speak the soft word that turns away wrath. And if you can do that, you can have productive and civil conversations with anyone on any subject.
Justice Kelly, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Daniel Kelly served as a state Supreme Court justice from 2016 until 2020. Now he's one of four candidates running for an open seat on the state Supreme Court. In just a moment, we'll meet another contender in that race. That's up next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with candidates for the state Supreme Court ahead of the primary election on February 21st. Janet Protasiewicz joins us now. She's a Milwaukee County Circuit Court judge and a former prosecutor. Judge Protasiewicz, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
Can you start with your elevator pitch, a half a minute or so, on why you're running for the state's highest court?
Did you say 2 hours or a half a minute? The reason I'm running for the state Supreme Court is to bring back change and common sense to our court. I'm a follow-the-law, common-sense judge, not an uber-partisan. There has been so much extreme partisanship on our Wisconsin Supreme Court, and that's why I'm running.
As political groups and interest groups line up, they view you as a liberal, those who support you, those who oppose you. What would you say to them?
I would say that, you know, labels are interesting and that, yes, I am very, very progressive when it comes to social issues. But I would also say that there are issues that, quite frankly, you know, go across all party lines, such as community safety, such as a judicial philosophy, such as being a fair jurist, such as being not a partisan, such as not having a thumb on the scale when it comes to issues that are going to come before the Supreme Court, such as not being an activist judge. You know, we need common sense. We don't need extreme partisanship, and I will root every decision in the law.
One decision or one case likely to come before the state Supreme Court, again, is the state's election maps. You've described the current maps and the system that created them unfavorably. Could, say, Republicans, if this case came before you as a Supreme Court justice, count on you to not have your thumb on the scale?
Absolutely. I said that the maps are rigged. And, you know, Wisconsin's a battleground state. I don't think you could sell to any rational person that the maps are fair. You just look at them with the numbers in the Wisconsin State Senate, the numbers in the Wisconsin State Assembly. You just look at those numbers, you know, when you know that something is wrong. But what I have told everyone, while I state that those maps are rigged and while I talk about some of the other issues that are important to both me and all Wisconsinites, is that all of my decisions are going to be, you know, rooted in the law, that I plan to follow the law, that I tell you what my values are, because I think that Supreme Court candidates should share with the community and the electorate what their values are. But nonetheless, I will uphold the law, follow the Constitution when I make any decisions. Nothing is prejudged.
After the U.S. Supreme Court struck down Roe v. Wade, we have the 1849 ban on most abortions in effect in Wisconsin. There's a lawsuit, though, the State Justice Department saying, hang on, there's a 1980s law, and they're in conflict with each other. How would you weigh the older law versus the newer law?
You know, basically, I can't make any specific comments as to what I would do when elected as a Supreme Court justice. And what I've told people in regard to the abortion law, in regard to the 1849 law, I've been very, very clear that, again, my values are that women have the right to choose. I've stated that I disagreed with the Supreme Court's decision on this. And quite frankly, I was surprised when the United States Supreme Court decided to take away a fundamental right that so many people in our country had for such a long time. I'd also say that this is the same type of decision-making that people are tired of. They're really tired of. They don't want that from our Wisconsin Supreme Court. So, you know, we currently have a majority on the court who are making decisions based on right-wing partisan beliefs, not the Constitution and not the law. We need to bring that change back to the courts. We need to get away from that right-wing extremism and back to common sense.
I'm asking the candidates for the court about collegiality on the court. If you're criticizing current rulings as right-wing extremism, would you be able to have a collegial relationship with, if elected, your fellow judges?
Of course. You know, people disagree on different issues. They agree on ways to analyze different issues. It doesn't mean that you can't be collegial with them. You know, I have lots of friends on all ends of the political spectrum. And, you know, we like to have spirited debates and spirited conversations about the issues. So I don't anticipate that being an issue at all.
Talking to Janet Protasiewicz, Milwaukee County Circuit Court judge, one of the candidates for Wisconsin's open state Supreme Court seat, a primary election coming up. recusal. Sometimes judges are asked by parties to remove themselves from a case. What is your standard, or what would be your standard as a state Supreme Court justice, of when, it's rare, but when to recuse yourself from a particular case?
Well, I think there needs to be a recusal rule. I have been very, very open about that. And, you know, just what the standard and what the contribution limit needs to be in order to have someone recuse themselves, I think that there needs to be a public hearing. I think the public absolutely needs to weigh in on that. But, I really, really believe a recusal rule is appropriate, you know, for lots of reasons. Other candidates have opposed, additional rules. I think that's wrong. I will obviously follow any recusal rule. But there are people who really believe that, so much money is being poured into these races and so much of it by outside groups. Should a Supreme Court justice really sit on a case where, millions of dollars of outside money has, come in on your behalf? And I don't think that people think that's fair. I think that people think that that puts a thumb on the scale. So I think we need a recusal rule. I plan to follow that recusal rule, and I hope that that is determined by a, public hearing on the matter.
A court race is a strange kind of race in the American political system. Usually you're voting for politicians to enact certain policies or not. How would you invite voters to weigh the decisions they make when voting for a judge at any level?
Well, I think you have to look at the person's judicial philosophy, how they plan to run their courtroom, how they plan to treat people, whether or not they are, able to be fair and appropriate under, all circumstances. Judicial philosophy, it's critical. Like I tell people, I can't tell you where I'm going to end up on a case, but I can tell you I'm going to root my decisions in the law. And so I go back to that change in common sense theme that I've been talking about, that we need to get away from hyper-partisanship and predetermined outcomes by ideologues. And, we absolutely need to do that. The Supreme Court should be, different in many instances than the other branches of government. People should really, really be able to look up to our Supreme Court and believe that it is a bastion of dignity and integrity, and that they are going to have a fair shake, across the board in our courts. So, I think that it is critically, critically important that we get back to those values.
You've talked some about your judicial philosophy. Could you talk more about how you'd like to see parties, plaintiffs, citizens treated by judges at all levels in the court?
Well, at all levels. And I'll tell you, I handle a domestic violence calendar for over a year. And I looked at the victims of those cases. We would set those jury trials for either 8:30 or 9 in the morning. And I knew, the victims were, dropping off kids at school, that they had, transportation issues. I knew defendants had transportation issues. And we always tried to be really attuned to that so that people really felt like they were respected across the board. We have an open, welcoming courtroom, and, everybody's treated fairly. Nothing's predetermined. Decisions are rooted in law. People are all treated with respect.
We'll leave it there. Judge Protasiewicz, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Janet Protasiewicz, a Milwaukee County Circuit Court judge, one of four candidates running for a seat on the state Supreme Court. Earlier, we heard from a former state Supreme Court Justice Daniel Kelly. Tomorrow at this time, we'll also talk to another one of the candidates, Dane County Judge Everett Mitchell. The primary election for the Supreme Court race is on February 21st. You can find information about registration and voting at myvote.wi.gov. That's .gov. And by the way, join WPR tonight at 8 for live coverage of the 2023 State of the Union Address. President Joe Biden will deliver the address to a joint meeting of Congress. NPR has live special coverage of that speech and of the Republican Party's response. That's special coverage of the 2023 State of the Union Address tonight at 8. You can listen live here on Wisconsin Public Radio and at WPR.org. And then tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, Kate and her guests break down that State of the Union address, looking at the domestic policy statements in it, the international issues as well, all the big issues facing the nation as addressed by the president and Republicans, and the response from Congress. Then join Central Time tomorrow. We will also look at some of the political rhetoric. Did we hear bipartisan outreach or partisan line drawing? A lot of State of the Union coverage coming up on Wisconsin Public Radio. Listen to the live address tonight at 8. Then join us tomorrow on Central Time and tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Last week on the show, we listened back to a conversation about nerd culture and science fiction, fantasy, and comics and their roles in pop culture, plus their fans. We heard from a couple more of you along the way. Michael in Kaukauna says he was a sci-fi nerd back in high school in the 70s and was teased mercilessly, but he was not alone. He and a friend would play short clips from Star Trek episodes and be able to pick the episode they were from. And Sarah says you could be a nerd about anything. Her husband, for example, Sarah says, is a truck nerd who could talk for hours about his truck. It's about the time you put into it and the passion you get from it. Yeah, I think about that expanded concept of nerdery a lot. I also know a couple of car nerds in my life. Definitely known a lot of music nerds along the way. I'm borderline a music nerd myself. Here at Central Time, we even have a cheese nerd. So yeah, whatever you nerd out about, let your nerd flag fly. This is Central Time.